second lecture on recurrent neural networks. So in the last lecture, we have talked a bit about how we can define recurrent neural networks as generic wave function ansatz for the purpose of finding ground states of some generic Hamiltonian. We have seen that these architectures were mainly used in the context of language modeling. And we kind of took this whole machinery and applied it into the context of quantum many-body physics. So what we tried to do is to define this ansatz wave function. And then what we did is we defined an expectation value of the Hamiltonian into our ansatz. And what we did is the idea is to optimize the parameters of our RNN using some sort of gradient descent so that we can go optimize and find an approximation of the ground state. And we argued that in principle, this is an intractable quantity, but in the last lecture, we showed that we can do this with a tractable cost by the mean of variational Monte Carlo, where we can take a finite number of samples. So it's still manageable using classical resources. Okay? And also in the last lecture, we have defined two kinds of RNN wave functions. The first one we call the positive RNN wave function. So this is useful when we want to target stochastic Hamiltonians, which have ground states with positive amplitudes. Okay, so this is when you have off-diagonal elements that are negative, such as in a transverse-field Ising model. So here what we only need is just probabilities, and then take the square roots to get our ansatz wave function. So what we do is we go through the sequence of RNNs, and then each time we go through the softmax layers to compute the conditional probabilities, and then we take the product and then the square root to get the value of our amplitude for a certain configuration sigma. Okay? And then we can also do this generically for, let's say, a non-stochastic Hamiltonian. So we can here define what's called a complex RNN wave function, where it's very similar to the positive one, where the difference here is that we add another layer in addition to the softmax layer, which we called SS, which is the based on the soft sign layer, where we use it to define phases. So what we do is we decompose the phase into a sum of conditional phases in a similar way to what do we decompose the probability into a product of conditionals. So we compute these conditional phases using this softmax layers, and then we add them up, and this will give us the phase of our RNN amplitude over here. Okay? Is this clear to everyone so far? Or if it's not clear, I can take some time to explain again. So far, so good? Okay. And in the last lecture, we also seen an example of the simplest RNN cell, which is the vanilla RNN. So we have seen that in the RNN, we have the vanilla RNN, we have a recursion relation where we compute those hidden states or memory states H over there. So this is the example of just when you have three spins. So sorry, here. So missing sigma 2. So we can do this for any system size. So once you go from one cell to the other, we do this kind of relation here, where we compute h of n based on the value of h of n minus 1 and sigma n minus 1, okay? And we've seen also that the variational parameters, or the parameters we tune using gradient descent, are actually those matrices W, V, and U, and also the biases B and C, okay? And for computing the conditionals, we use the softmax layer, and we do the dot products with the one-hot encoding of each individual value of spins. Okay, so far so good. Okay, so now in this lecture, we're gonna see an advanced version of an RNN cell called the gated recurrent unit. So this will solve some of the main problems of this vanilla RNN that I'm gonna talk about in a second. So we'll talk about gated recurrent units. And the second part, we'll also see how we can generalize these RNNs to two-dimensional structures. So inherently, this looks only one-dimensional, like what you have seen with matrix product states in tensor networks. We'll see how we can generalize them to 2D, like what you've seen in PEPs in tensor networks. So I have 2D RNNs. And if we have time, we'll talk about how we can apply symmetries on top of RNNs. OK? So let's try to go through this plan, OK? So let's get started with the first section on gated recurrent units. Also known as a GRU. Okay. So the main reason these special RNNs exist is because of a problem called the vanishing gradient problem, or the exploding gradient problem. So this is clear through this example that I'm going to mention here. It's more intuitive to think about sentences as compared to spin configuration. So I'm going to take an example of a long sentence so that you're going to see why there is an issue with a vanilla RNN. Okay? So let's take the example of the following sentence. Let's say the city and then a comma, which is located in, let's say, Ontario. And which is very populated and then a comma, we say at the end, is beautiful. Okay, so this is an example of a very long sentence. Okay, we can come up maybe with something longer, but the point here is that this noun here is singular, right? And what we need to make sure to so that this sentence is grammatically correct, we need to make sure that we have the correct form of the verb to be here, which is, not are. Okay? So we need to kind of ignore all of this information and only get information about the fact that this is a singular noun, not a plural noun, okay? In RNNs, vanilla RNNs, this is an issue because kind of the information that comes from the city throughout the recursion relation is forgotten as you do this recursion relation. To give you an idea about why this happens, let's think about a very simple example where the size of the vector h is just 1, which means that h is a number. So let's think of h as a number, and let's forget about the nonlinear activation function f. So let's say h of n is, so w will be in this case just a number, and then we'll have hn minus 1. Let's also think of sigma as a number, okay? So we'll have v and then sigma n minus 1. Okay, and let's also forget about the bias, just for simplicity. So let's say we have a very simple recursion relation. Okay, now if we apply this recursion relation again on sigma n minus 1, you will have w and then hn minus 2 plus v sigma n minus 2, okay, plus v sigma n minus 1, right? And then we can keep doing this again and again and again until at some point you'll get something like the following. So we will have w to the n minus 1 h1, okay, and then plus w to the n minus 2 times v sigma 1, right? And we'll have other terms, okay? But we'll just focus on those two terms, and then we'll have some other terms that will depend on the other indices, okay? So is this clear, for this transition clear so far? Okay, so now the thing that might happen is that, let's say the absolute value of w is smaller than 1, then if n is very large, okay, this is the case, for example, if you have a very long sentence, this factor will decay very fast. So this factor will decay exponentially, and this factor will decay exponentially. Okay? So in particular, the contribution of the information that's coming from the first element is becomes very irrelevant to the value we compute over here. Okay? The same thing also for the other factors in the sum. Okay, so this is a very, very like bad limitation. Like this is like not a good thing to happen, because if you want to make the good prediction over here, we need the correct information from a word that's very far away. Yes.
What do you have in the? Is that w or psi? No. That is less than 1.
Yeah, less than 1. Yeah, sorry, that's w. Right. Sorry. So if we have that, that's exponential decay. Now, if it's larger than 1, we'll have even an explosion. And that's also bad, because when you want to compute gradients, you'll get gradients explosion. That's also not good. But at least like this is even bad, because like when you have something that's very close to 1, you will have a hard time to magnify the signal, as opposed to when you have a very large signal, you can just cut off like a certain threshold. Okay, so at least like I want you to see the point that this is a limitation of vanilla RNNs. So because of that, we'll introduce what's called a gating mechanism inside our RNN cell. So we'll, instead of this recursion relation, we'll change it to another recursion relation. So we'll do the following. The idea is very simple. So we'll do the following thing. So we will define what's called a candidate hidden state, Hn tilde. And that's defined out of the previous hidden states and the previous input. And here we'll use the same matrices, and we add a bias, and then here we're going to use a nonlinear activation function. Typically, people in machine learning use the hyperbolic tangents, so that these elements are between minus 1 and 1. We don't have necessarily to do this, but it looks like this keeps the inputs between minus 1 and 1, and avoids also gradient explosion. And we also define another vector, that's the gate, and I'm going to talk about it in a second. And this is defined in a similar way. So we use the previous hidden states and the previous inputs, and we have some other matrices, VG, WG, and another bias, BG. And then here we use a sigmoid as a nonlinear activation function, so that this number is between 0 and 1. So for those who are not familiar with sigmoids, so it's defined as 1 over 1 over 1 plus the exponential of minus x. Okay? It's like very similar to the Fermi distribution that you've learned in condensed matter. So it's like very interesting point to make here. Now, The difference compared to the vanilla RNN is that the hidden state is computed as a combination of the current candidate state and the previous hidden state. Okay? So this is done as follows. So first, we take our candidate hidden state, h tilde, and hn minus 1, that's the previous hidden state. What we do is we keep some of the new hidden state, and we also keep some of the previous hidden state. Okay, so this symbol here is the dot, is the Hadamard product, means that we do the product between spins elements wise. Okay, so this is not the dot product, but we take two vectors, A, B, A prime, B prime. So this will give us A prime, B, B prime. Okay? Sounds good? So the idea here is that we take a combination of the current information and also the information from the past, and still this will be between minus 1 and 1. Okay? Because the sigmoid is between 0 and 1, and also all the h elements of the hidden states are still between minus 1 and 1. So still, h will be bounded between minus 1 and 1, okay? So this is the construction. So now let's see why this is helpful so that we can do something overcome the issue of exponential decay. So to do this, let's take an example. Before going through the example, are there any questions about the GRU construction? This is the simplified version. There's more advanced versions of it, but I wanted just to define the notion of the gates, since this is the most important one here. Okay.
But to get HN, do we need to solve equation, because you have it on the left side and on the right side?
So to get, you mean HN? So we only need hn minus 1 and hn tilde. So it's not an equation. We already know what's hn minus 1 and what's hn tilde. And then, so we go through the three equations sequentially. We first find hn tilde, then we find gn, and then we find hn.
Oh, okay.
Okay? Yeah. So it's not a system of equations. We go through it sequentially. Yeah, thank you for the question. Yeah. So now let's go through again the example of the sentence I defined over there. So we have the city, which is, and then da da da. So we have something that's irrelevant. And then at some point we have the word is, indicating that this is singular. And then the word beautiful. Okay? So the idea is, can be simple here. So what we do initially, let's imagine that H, to understand this very well, it's good to think about the extreme examples where H, G, and N are, H and G are just numbers, okay? So this is just a hidden state with dimension 1. So in this case, let's imagine initially that the word city give us a signal h equal to 1, okay? Meaning that this signal h equal to 1 means that the word is singular, and you can think of 0 as the word is plural, okay? So let's think about this. Imagine this is the case here. And what we want the GRU to learn here is that we want to keep this information. So this is something that's very relevant. So you want to set the gate to 1, okay? If the gate is 1, then we don't remember the past. So 1 minus j, 1 minus g is 0. So we forget about the past and we only keep the current information. Now, this information is irrelevant. So we have to keep, we have to do g equals 0. If we do g equals 0, we forget the current information, but we keep the information from the past, which is h equal to 1. So now h will be still 1. Is this clear to anyone? Yeah, it's good. So this is irrelevant. We don't remember it. Same thing here. This is not irrelevant. This is not relevant. And then we forget it. And then we do this many times. We keep the gates 0, 0, 0 by learning the correct parameters. And then here, to make sure that the generated word is so that it's consistent with this word is being singular, we use the information that we remembered through the sequence in order to generate the correct word. Okay? So what we did is we tried to keep this information throughout the sequence and then use it to generate the correct word over here, which is something that it's not obvious to do with a vanilla RNN. Does this example give you at least an idea why the gating mechanism is helpful? Okay. So this is in the case when H is only one-dimensional. You can think of H being multidimensional, where you can remember a lot of information, like not only the fact that this word is singular, but maybe other features. And you can, just by the idea of, by analogy, you can also think of the same thing when you're studying as quantum, like spin systems or some other physical system. Okay? You can remember the magnetization or some other property and then carry it out to predict maybe the value of the next spin. Okay? Is this analogy good to anyone? Cool. Yes?
So think about like when I inputted just another piece of sentence and then put it, how can I know like initialization, like which one to remember?
That's a great question. So your question is like how did we know that we need to remember this?
Yeah.
Right, that's a great question. So this is actually the process of learning through gradient descent. So we just ran initially we initialize those parameters randomly. We initialize those matrices and biases randomly. And because we want to minimize the energy expectation value, the RNN has to learn in such a way that we keep the correct information or we forget about the irrelevant information. So this is, everything is learnable. We don't have to we don't have to hard code this by hand. The mechanism is there to forget or to keep information. And through gradient descent, kind of the RNN learns what's to keep and what's to forget. Okay? Does that answer your question? Okay. So in summary, yes?
As a follow-up to that question, some things are still not clear to me about how the network does that, although I'm rationalizing that as being part of why it's called a black box.
Yeah.
Following this question, I'm trying to think how exactly, it's almost as if we just assume, based on the optimization from the gradient descent, do your thing and...
Yeah.
The question I have about that is that, is there some, now in machine learning, what you talk about,
interpretability, right?
Yeah. Is there anything like that that is adapted to this?
Right, that's a great question. So since we have like nonlinear activation functions, right, that's very hard to interpret. But this example is just for you for the purpose of illustrating that in the best case scenario where we learned the correct weights and biases, then this is what we want to happen. But if we already have optimized some architecture with hundreds or thousands of parameters, even millions, that's very hard to interpret. So that's one of the downsides, at least for physicists, that's really not appealing. But hopefully, like maybe with some other techniques, we could maybe open the black box and understand what's going on. That's I would be like that's will be interesting area of research. Great question. Yeah. So, in conclusion, the GRU allows to learn long range correlations. If you're thinking about a spin system or some other physical system. Okay, so now if, after discussing the GRU, now we can move on to how we can generalize these RNNs to two-dimensional structures so that we can study two-dimensional systems. Two-dimensional RNNs. Okay. So from what you can see, at least from this recursion relation, things are actually inherently one-dimensional, okay? So you can still like process like a two-dimensional system by this 1D recursion relation, but at least that would not be optimal because we're not exploiting the structure of the 2D system. Yeah, there's a question, Lauren.
Just a minute ago, somebody asked a question.
No worries.
So I think they're probably referring back to the GRU.
Yeah, for sure.
Just wanted to confirm, is this still unsupervised learning? So the
yes.
data on its own will learn city and both singular, and that's the pattern that exists.
That's a great question. So still, this is an unsupervised learning approach. So the example I gave there is just an analogy for what happens when you have a spin configuration where, let's say, you have a spin that's very correlated to like two spins far from each other but still correlated. So, for instance, you could have that in a ground state of some very strongly correlated system. So this sentence is just an analogy for what could happen in a physical system. So still, this is unsupervised. So all we want is just to minimize the energy. And we don't have any data set. All the data set is actually generated by the RNN each time we do the optimization through autoregressive sampling. I hope that will answer the question.
I'll let you know.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so now let's talk about two-dimensional RNNs. So what we mentioned here is that RNNs are inherently one-dimensional. So let's say we want to use a conventional RNN to study a two-dimensional system. So let's imagine that we have a 2D system. Let's say, for instance, 4x4 spin system. And let's say we want to label these spins through this order. So here, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then 5, 6, 7, 8, and then here 9, 10, 11, 12, and so on and so forth. Okay?
So are you going to picture recognition?
Yeah, so you kind of have a picture and then you flatten it into one vector. So this is what could happen if we want to study a 2D system with a regular RNN, like 1D RNN, okay? So we'll choose like a path like this one, and then go here, and then. So this will be, for instance, the sampling path that we use for autoregressive sampling. As you've seen also with matrix product states with Martin in the previous lectures, okay? So now the issue is, that you might have guessed is that if we go, for instance, from spin four to five, we're actually having a direct connection between the two, but they're actually not physically close to each other. Okay? So this is one limitation. So we're not actually exploiting the correct structure of the system. So four, and 5 are not close to each other, but still directly connected. Okay. And so this is kind of a non-local connection, which is not good. Is you have seen also that this is not good when the case of matrix products, say, when you have a non-local connection. It's good to avoid these kind of connections. And we can also see the same thing, for instance, 1 and 5 are directly connected, let's say, by some physical bond and some physical interaction, but still they are not directly connected when we go through the recursion relation. Okay, so they are connected through a sequence of steps. And this is also not good because we could have forgotten some information about one while still going through the sequence, although they are directly connected. Okay, so this is also a limitation. So 1 and 5 are physically connected, are not directly connected in this picture. Okay. Now we can also think of another path for sampling. So we can maybe do the following thing. So this sampling path is not the only one we can do. We can also think of this path. This is called the zigzag path. Okay, so here you can see that we kind of solve, like, for instance, the fact that 4 and 8 are not physically connected but not directly connected for the RNN. We kind of solved that with this zigzag path, but we actually made the distance between how many, like, we kind of enlarge the number of steps to go through 1 to 5. So we made this problem even worse, okay? So it's kind of like, it's very hard. If you think only about one-dimensional, like, structures, it's very hard to, like, efficiently study a two-dimensional system with a 1D RNN, okay? Is this clear to anyone? It's good? Okay, so now to solve this issue, the idea is actually pretty, it's not complicated. So the idea is, like, just to introduce vertical connections. So instead of only having these horizontal connections between different spins, we can introduce vertical connections in a similar manner to what you have seen with the PEPS structure in tensor networks. So let's see how we can do this. Okay, so let me draw again the same pictures over there. So we have our lattices. And then the second one here. And then I'm gonna choose this. So this is for the previous sampling path, like the first one. So this is called in machine learning, it's called the raster scan. And this is the zigzag path. Okay. So here we'll take this path for the recursion relation that we have defined for the RNN. And now the novelty in order to study 2D systems is to introduce these connections. I'm going to show you how we can add these connections in a second. Okay. Same thing for the other picture. So here we take a zigzag path. Okay, and now here, again, we introduce some additional vertical connections. Okay, so I'm showing you that the two paths, like, just to give you an idea about how this idea, like how the idea of 2DRNN comes into being, like what was the thought process when we were discussing with, or collaborating with my collaborators, like when doing the research with my collaborators to figure out what's the correct path to make this efficient. Okay, so here we're thinking that we could either choose this sampling path or this one. Okay, now if we think about this first path over here, we still have these null local connection, which is not good. Same thing here. Same thing here. Okay, so this is not optimal, even though we have these vertical connections. Now, if we think about the zigzag path, you can see that the problem is kind of solved. Like, we kind of directly connect in the spins or the physical variables that are close to each other. So for instance, the problem that we had, for instance, with 1 and 5 is fixed over here. So we have a direct connection. Now, for instance, with 4 and 5, they're no longer connected with some non-local connection. Okay? So it's kind of this structure respects the two-dimensional structure of our 2D system that we want to study. Yeah.
Does the direction of the connection matter, or just for this visualization?
That's a great question. So to define what's the meaning of this connection, that's exactly what I wanted to cover, in the next part of the lecture. So. But I just want you to note that by sending messages in this way between different sites, this helps to correctly embed the structure of the 2D system into our two-dimensional RNN. Okay. So this idea was kind of like studied before in the context of machine learning, kind of was forgotten. Like in the literature. So this was studied by Alex Grave and collaborators. So this work was called multidimensional recurrent neural networks. You can look it up if you're interested. So people were using this for the purpose of machine learning, and it turns out that this idea was very useful also when you study two-dimensional systems. The sampling path was not known, the optimal one was not known at the time, but it turns out that in the research we were doing, like this zigzag, like this path of sampling is the optimal one. Okay? At least like this, it seems that it's working well in our experiments. Okay, so now to come back to your question, now how to define these messages that we send from one site to the other. So to do this, like let's come back to the example of the 1D RNN, where we have a one-dimensional recursion relation, where instead we're flattening a 2D structure into one-dimensional vector. So we have the following recursion relation. Right? So now in this case, what we're actually doing is like we're promoting the indices into two-dimensional indices. So instead of one index, each hidden state and each input will have two indices I and j. Okay? So for instance, let's say we're somewhere here. So that's index ij. This side here will receive information from I minus 1 site I minus 1 j, and also from this site, I j minus 1. Okay? Yes?
This equation, is that hn?
Yeah, that's hn, right?
And then you have hn minus 2?
Minus 1, sorry. Yeah, thank you. So here, what we want to compute is the hidden state at site ij, okay? So to compute this site ij, like this hidden state, we need information from this site and this site. So the available information from, let's say, from this site, so first we have the previous hidden state, which is ihi j minus 1, and also the input at that site, which is sigma ij minus 1. Okay, and from this site, we also have a similar set of information, which is h I minus 1 j and sigma I minus 1 j. Okay, so now we can think of something similar to vanilla RNN. We can multiply each element here with some weight matrix. So that will be, for instance, WV, which stands for vertical, and here V vertical, and then here W horizontal, and then V horizontal, and then we can just add everything together, and then add a bias by just taking, extrapolating through this picture, and then you could also add a nonlinear activation function. And with this, we have a two-dimensional recursion relation so that we can process information in a 1D manner, but still carry information about the previous spins in a way that respects the 2D structure of our physical system of interest. Okay? Is this clear to everyone?
So this can be generalized to three-dimensional.
Yeah, that's a great point, yeah. So we can do this in 3D, 4D, or you can generalize this to any dimensions you want. That's a great point, yeah.
But for language processing, would you want to go to 2D at any point? Or
no, so yeah.
In 1D?
Yeah, language is inherently one-dimensional, I guess, because like you're going through a sequence. So that's inherently, like, when you go through like a text or some paragraph, you go through it sequentially. So it is inherently one-dimensional. So, but for physical systems, we need to think about ways to generalize this, and this is one way to do it. There could be maybe better ways to do this. Okay. So this version of this recursion relation corresponds to the vanilla version of the 2D RNN. Okay. So this is a 2D vanilla RNN. You can also imagine doing the same thing, extrapolating this to a 2D gated RNN, and maybe a 3D gated RNN, or you can gluing the pieces together. You can imagine doing a lot of interesting stuff with this. Okay. So far, so good. Okay, and I should note also that in order to compute the conditional probabilities or the conditional phases, you can use the softmax on top of this hidden state, and then this will be similar to what we have seen with the 1D RNN. Okay? So now the interesting point I want to make is when we compare this to, let's say, tensor networks with the PEPs. So if we compare the cost of this architecture with the PEPs, we'll see something interesting. So if you count how many recursion relations we do throughout throughout the path of autoregressive sampling, we have in total n sites, and each time we have a certain cost for computing this hidden state. So if you want to compute the cost of a of sampling or a forward pass, through our 2D RNN, so that will be linear in the system size. And if you can think of the cost of, for instance, a matrix times a vector multiplication, so this matrix will have size, we have seen that should be dh by dh, where dh is a hyperparameter, which is the size of the hidden state. So a matrix times a vector multiplication, that should scale as dh squared. For the size of this is just 2, let's say if we have a spin. So like we'll here we'll have a matrix dh by 2, so that's linear in dh. So in total, we'll have nh by dh squared. Okay? Now if we compare this, for instance, to the PAP structure, the pair entangled projected states, then the, as we have seen with Martin in the previous lectures, like the cost of contracting a PEPS that's intractable exactly. And if you're thinking about doing this with approximate methods, I think the optimal scaling for a approximate method is given by the following, where D is the bond dimension of the PEPS, and this guy here is the bond dimension of an intermediate matrix product state that's used to for the purpose of approximating the contraction of the PEPS. So it's still, you can see that by doing the approximate contraction, we have an exponent to the 6 over here, whereas for the RNN, that's to the 2. So in some sense, this way of doing it using this recursion relation is kind of cheaper compared. It allows to achieve higher values of dh as compared to, for instance, a PEPS where you'll be maybe limited to small values of the bond dimension. Okay? So I just wanted to highlight this, like this, this point to show you that we can, this like a lot, some promise of complementing some of the limitations that we have, for instance, with the PEPS structure. Yes?
I think it's good that we have you and Martin around at the same time. I don't think this would be an argument, but it would be nice to see from the perspectives of both of you, there's a problem.
Right.
I'm a PEPS expert, I'm an RNN expert, and we're on the same team. How do we arrive at
this?
What approach do we use to solve this problem?
So I think the answer is we'll never arrive at one approach because it will be hard because the approach has to depend on the problem. So, you know, I mean, it is in some sense, I don't think PEPS is a method that will solve every problem for you, but it will solve some of them, you know, better than other methods. And then there may be some cases where PEPS fail or will struggle, and then other methods like RNNs, for example, may work better. I don't think that one is like exclusively better than the other in all applications. I would, you know, it's probably not gonna happen. So that is sort of the attitude here. One has to see which method works best for which problem. So PEPS has advantages. So so Mohammed was saying you have like a large, it scales very poorly with bond dimension, but then you may only require a small bond dimension in some cases, right? So there are cases, there are certain states you can represent exactly with a small bond dimension. And it would, for example, be interesting to see how well would an RNN approximate those. So, you know, it's like you have to weigh off the pros and cons of every method.
as given, you know, for each problem that you're trying to solve.
Yeah, that's a great point. And just to also complement what Martin said, like we can also maybe merge the two approaches together. So for instance, we could have maybe a tensorized version of a recurrent neural network. So for instance, instead of having like an additive operation here, we can have a tensorized operation. So for instance, you can think of like the following recursion relation, where you have your previous input and your previous hidden state, and you tensorize them together using some tensor like what we have in matrix product states, and you add a bias. So if you remove the nonlinear activation function and the bias, you'll be like kind of have an NMPS. And if you add these kind of like nonlinearities and biases, you could maybe have a richer structure. So I think like merging these two approaches together would be something also interesting to explore in the future. Yeah, does that answer your question? Cool. So now I think if everything is clear with respect to the 2D structure, now we can move on to briefly how we can implement symmetries on RNNs. Okay. As I've said, like as mentioned in a previous comment, we can also generalize this to higher dimensions with this using the same approach. Right.
Monte Carlo, there is something called the worm algorithm.
The worm algorithm?
So updating single spins, take a worm like line and then
yes.
Update. So are there similar things here?
That's a great point, yeah. So what we do here, the approach of sampling here is actually exact. Yeah. So when you do autoregressive sampling, when you do this sequentially, multiple times you can get a lot of samples that are uncorrelated. So you kind of like, you don't have to worry about the kind of updates. So you don't need to design any updates for your Monte Carlo. Everything is taken care of by the RNN. So this is one of the nice things about these architectures. You can do this for spin glass models, for instance, without having to think about some, like the autocorrelation problem where you have some very rugged landscape. So you can draw like samples from a multimodal distribution. You can jump between modes of the distribution without having to do like local jumps. This is like one of the main advantages of using this approach. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Okay, so now let's move on to symmetries. Applying symmetries on top of the RNN. Okay. So as you might have noticed in the sampling path that we chose for instance, to get us like a 2D configuration, we actually chose some order to get our spins. So that's a priori that's not physical, so that's just one order we choose in order to do the autoregressive sampling to respect the autoregressive property of our RNN, but in principle that's not physical. So we kind of violate some physical constraints by doing this. And to correct this, we need to kind of apply symmetries to correct for this bias that we introduced in our sampling. So for instance, let's say we have a 1D system where we go from left to right to get our spin configuration. Let's say we have a spin configuration and we generate our four spins by going from left to right. Okay? So this will, for instance, if you have a system where you have the flip symmetry, where it doesn't matter whether you go from left to right or right to left, this is not good, right? This is not a good way of sampling. So what we can do is also think about the other path, where we go from right to left. Okay? And what we can do here is we can take what to implement the symmetry. Maybe I can throw the question to you, like, do you have an idea about what we can do to implement, let's say, the parity symmetry by sampling this way and this way?
Maybe if you fix weights or something like that.
Right, yeah. So we kind of do the probability of sampling this way and a probability of sampling this way, right? So we can sample this way, like one half of the time, and half of the time, and then this way half of the time. Okay, so you have 0.5 probability of computing the amplitude of this configuration by sampling this way, and 0.5 probability of sampling this way. Okay, and you can see that by flipping the configuration, will not matter how you sample. You'll implement this symmetry, which is, for instance, let's say we have four spins. Let's imagine for simplicity that the amplitude is positive, meaning that this is a square root of a probability. Then if we do this, then you'll see that this constraint will be applied, meaning that if you flip the order of the spin configuration, this by sampling from right to left by 50% chance, and then from right to left by 50% chance, you will be able to implement exactly this symmetry. And this will allow us to improve the accuracy of our variational calculation. Okay? And this is in the case where the amplitude is positive. We can also do this, generalize this to the case when we have complex amplitudes. So I won't go through this because of time, but you're more than welcome to check the notes I'll be sharing to see how we can generalize this to the case when we have a phase term. Okay? And we can also, so this is the case when we have a 1D system. You can also do this when you have a 2D system where you have rotational symmetries. So let's say you have a 4D system where you have a C4 symmetry, meaning like a four rotations symmetry. So what you can do is, for instance, sample this way 1/4 of the time, and then rotate this system by 90 degrees, and then choose the same sampling path, and then 90 degrees again, and then 90 degrees again, and then you add things together with 25% chance probability. And this will allow you to implement the C4 symmetry. And you can imagine doing this for other types of symmetries. Okay, so this is the case when we have discrete symmetries. You can also imagine doing this for continuous symmetries, like the U1 symmetry. So for instance, you know, like when you have the Heisenberg model, so the Heisenberg model, we have the anti-ferromagnetic interactions between spin 1/2. And we know that this system has like SU2 symmetry. It's not, so up to now, like it's not clear how to do this on the RNN, but I want to show you how to do this on using the U1 symmetry. So we know that we know that the magnetization along the Z direction commutes with the Hamiltonian, meaning that our Hamiltonian has U1 symmetry. And this means that if we compute the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian, they will have a fixed magnetization. Okay? In particular, if you look at the ground state of this Hamiltonian, the ground state has zero magnetization. Okay? So for instance, if you decompose the ground set into the computational basis, then the amplitudes will be always zero if the configuration violates the zero magnetization constraints. So it will be good also to impose this on the RNN level. So to do this, the idea is as follows. So I'm going to use another board. So the idea is like to project configurations with invalid zero, the invalid constraints, we project them to zero probability. So this is done as follows. So let's say we only have four spins. So let's say initially we generated up and then the next step, we again generated the spin up. We only have four spins, the next two spins has to be, both of them has to be down, right? So that we have zero magnetization. Okay, so if we again do the RNN step here, then we will get some two-dimensional probability, right? So it will be, let's say for instance, we'll get the following. So we'll get 0.9 and 0.1. Here we'll have 90% chance to get spin down and 10% chance to get spin up. Okay? But still, because of that, like the fact that there's a non-zero probability to get spin up, we might sample a spin up here. So what we want to directly exactly impose this zero magnetization constraint is what we do is we project. We project this number to zero. And then to conserve the normalization constraints of our RNN, we renormalize this in such a way that this vector is normalized. Okay, so we normalize. And then with this projection step, we'll have always 100% chance to get spin down on the third spin. And then if we do this again on the fourth spin, we'll also have 100% chance to get spin down, and we'll have no violations of this constraint when we construct our ansatz to target our ground state. Okay, so this is the high-level idea of how we can implement a U1 symmetry. For SU2, that will be an interesting area of research. So, to the best of my knowledge, we don't know how to do this for the RNN. Okay, and so. So this is pretty much what I wanted to discuss today on the blackboard in the lecture. I want to show you some other results on RNNs on the slides. So for that, I just want to ask if I can have the slides down, please. Yeah. Can I have the screen down, please? Thank you. In the meantime, if you have any questions, feel free to let me know.
Also online, you're welcome to ask questions.
Yeah. Yeah.
Problem is, I think the online audience
won't be able to see. Okay.
But I mean, I think probably as soon as, oh, I think, yeah, okay, we got it online.
Okay, thanks very much. Yeah.
Great.
Okay, great. So just to sum up what we have discussed in the previous two lectures, what we did is we defined an RNN wave function with some tunable parameters. We want to target the ground state of some Hamiltonian of our interest. What we do is we run gradient descent, we run D, we optimize the parameters until we eventually find an approximation of the ground state as well as the ground state energy of our system of interest. So we have seen that we can define this for a stochastic Hamiltonian where we only care about the conditional probabilities and take the square roots to get our positive amplitude. And we can also do this for a non-stochastic Hamiltonian where we introduce these conditional phases that allow us to construct an amplitude, an ansatz wave function with complex phases.
Sorry, the name stochastic, was it intentional in the previous?
Yeah, so this is for stochastic Hamiltonians, yeah.
It's normal, spelling is stochastic. So you are talking about quantum, that's why it's stochastic, is it?
Oh.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is like the, yeah. Yeah, this is like quantum stochastic. Yeah.
Roger,
so,
that
yeah. Yeah, so this is for, the complex RNN is used for the non-quantum stochastic Hamiltonian. And just to show you some recent results we obtained with the RNN structure. So what we did is we applied this on the transduced field Eisen model or the quantum Eisen model, where we have ferromagnetic couplings between neighboring spins, and also we also have spin-flipped coupling, which corresponds to disorder in the system. And this is basically the Hamiltonian, and which is also stochastic here because of off, negative off-diagonal elements. So we have a competition between order and disorder. And of course, like as we have seen, if you represent this as a matrix that's 2 to the n by 2 to the n, it's not efficient to diagonalize it. And the ground state will be a superposition of different spin configurations because of the fact that you have a competition between order and disorder. So what we do is we target this for a system of 1,000 spins. And we target the hardest points, which is the critical points of this Hamiltonian, H equal to 1, which is the transduced field. And we find that by training the RNN, initially, like we have a large error. And then by training, we saturate to an error that corresponds to an RNN energy that's close to the exact ground state energy. And beyond this, by conversion to the ground state, we can also compute observables. So we can take our optimized RNN wave function to compute two-point correlation functions along the z-axis and also along the x-axis. And we compare this with DMRG, which is the gold standard in 1D. We find a very good agreement. And we can also compute entanglement entropies. So in particular, we compute the second Rennie entropy, which we can do through sampling. And we also find a good agreement with DMRG. And something interesting to note regarding symmetry, for instance, if we implement the flip symmetry that we've discussed, we can see that the symmetric RNN is more accurate compared to the other RNN. Okay, so this is one manifestation of where symmetry can be helpful. And we also applied this to a non-stochastic Hamiltonian, for instance, the 1D, J1, J2 model. So the no sign here means that when we don't apply any sign structure on our ansatz before, on our RNN ansatz before, so this is corresponds to these accuracies for different values of this J2. What we found, it will be helpful also to impose like what's called the Marshall sign structure on top of the RNN ansatz, and this helps to improve significantly the variational accuracy in the case where we know that the Marshall sign still holds, for instance, for small values of J2. For large values of J2, the Marshall sign don't hold anymore, so the accuracy doesn't improve significantly there. Okay. And in 2D, we apply the same idea that we have discussed earlier, so we choose this zigzag path for sampling configurations. And we do this for we applied this on the 2D transverse fit Eisen model with the same structure, where here we don't know exactly what's the ground state, so it's not known theoretically. And we have compared here with DMRG and with another machine learning structure called the Pixel CNN, where here we kind of made a competition where the lower the energy, the better, meaning the closer you are to the ground state. And we did this for different values of the transverse magnetic field. Okay? And we find, so this guy here corresponds to the bond dimension of the DMRG we compared with. And you can see over here, for in particular, for the value that's close to the critical point of this model, the 2D RNN has the lowest energy compared to the other competitors. And what's even more interesting here is that the RNNs are actually more compact compared to DMRG and Pixel CNN, where we have orders of magnitude less parameters compared to DMRG and also to the Pixel CNN structure. So this is one of the appealing features of two-dimensional RNNs. And we also apply this to the 2D Heisenberg model on the first on the square lattice. So this is to show you the power of implementing symmetries. So this is the accuracy when you don't have any symmetries. And this is when you apply U1 symmetry, which is the zero magnetization. And this is when you apply U1 plus the four rotations. So you get even more significant accuracy. And this is when you apply four rotations and four reflections symmetry. So this is C4V. So by applying more symmetries, you can get the same, you can get better accuracy using the same set of parameters. So that's something interesting. So it was interesting to observe this effect. And also on the 10 by 10 square lattice, we observed that our 2D RNN is also competitive with state-of-the-art methods, including PEPs, Pixel CNN, and also DMRG. But still, yeah, QMC is the gold standard if we think about like stochastic Hamiltonians. And on the triangular lattice, where QMC is no longer efficient, we compare with DMRG, and we find that for system sizes that are below some threshold size, DMRG is still better. But we know from DMRG that the larger the system size, the more the bond dimension has to grow exponentially. So there we find that 2D RNNs kind of provide some advantage compared to DMRG, where we see that the difference between the we see that the RNN energy becomes lower compared to the DMRG energy beyond some system, beyond these larger for system sizes larger than these values of the system size. Okay. And we also tried to see whether RNNs can detect topological order in phases of matter. So this kind of order corresponds to the global behavior of some quantum system, as opposed to the case when we have, for instance, a local order parameter, for instance, a magnetization in a ferromagnet. So this is something harder to detect. And this is very useful in a wide range of phases of matter, like spin liquids, quantum Hall effect, or also in fault-tolerant quantum computation where you want to do topological quantum computing. And the interesting thing about these phases of matter that they can be characterized by what's called the topological entanglement entropy. So what we took as a challenge is to see whether we can compute this quantity out of our optimized RNN wave functions. So to do this, we look at the subleading behavior of the entanglement entropy. This is the second Rennie entropy, where what we do is we divide our system into two regions, A and B. And if we have, typically these systems have an area low, where the scaling of the entanglement entropy goes as the boundary between A and B. And if this system has topological order, then there is some quantity gamma that indicates that there is some topological order. And then we have some subleading terms. So the idea was to see whether we can detect that factor gamma And one way to do this is by doing finite size scaling. So you can take different system sizes of the boundary between your regions A and B, and then you extrapolate until you find, for instance, some value of gamma. For instance, if you get log 2, this means that you have what's called Z2 topological order. And you can also do some other constructions. In the literature, there's a construction called the Kitaev-Preskal construction, where you can take your system into four regions. And in the bulk of the system, it's divided into three different regions, A, B, C. And then you can compute the entanglement entropies. You can take these different combinations. And at the end, you get some estimation of the topological entanglement entropy. So first, we tried this on the toric code because we know that this model is the simplest model that establishes this kind of order, where we have different terms over here. So we have the Blackett terms, where we have the interactions between these four spins, where we do the product of all four spins together to get the value over here. And here we have vertices where we flip spins that belong to vertices using the sigma x Pauli matrices. And the ground state of this model turns out to have topological order. In particular, this Z2 topological order in the gamma, it's known theoretically that it's equal to log 2. So the question was whether we can detect this using an RNN. So the first thing we tried is to compute the entanglement entropy scaling with the system size. So what we found is, so those points are actually the entanglement entropy is computed by the RNN, in particular the second Reinier entropy. And by doing the finite size extrapolation, we find that we obtained a value that's close to log 2, which is a signal that we have topological order. There's some peculiarities here, the fact that when we divide, so the system we had was kind of like a torus, and we divided it into two cylinders. So when you do this, you have to do two cuts. It turns out that there's some peculiarities here with the fact that you get either a superposition of different topological states or only one topological state. So this was a bit not a conclusive proof that we got topological order. Instead, what we try to do is to use the Kitaev-Preskal construction, where we don't cut the system into, we don't change the topology of the system by cutting it into through, as we do, for instance, when you cut the torus into two cylinders. So here, when we did the construction for the Kitaev-Preskal, we got, for different system sizes, we got exactly log 2. And this was a good test that RNNs can detect topological order for the toric code. We also targeted another system which has topological order, which is the Bose-Hubbard model on the Kagame lattice. So the idea, like if we want to study this using a 2D RNN, what we do is we map the Kagame lattice into a 2D square lattice by enlarging the Hilbert space. So we kind of consider that we have a bigger spin, which consists of three spins. So this is one way of mapping these kind of lattices to a simpler square lattice. So by studying this system, so first to explain what this system consists of, so we have a hopping term of, so these bosons are actually hardcore bosons, so there's only zero occupation or one occupation. We cannot have more than that. So there's a hopping term between neighbors, and we also have an interaction term that imposes this kind of configurations, meaning that we should have only exactly three bosons in each hexagon. If we have less than that or more than that, then we will have to pay a penalty energy, okay? And what turns out to happen is that beyond some value of the interaction V, we get a spin, Z2 spin liquid, which has topological order. So what we try to do is to compute the entanglement entropy, sorry, the topological entanglement entropy gamma. And we find that beyond some value of V, which is exactly close to 7, over here, we find that the topological entanglement entropy for different system sizes converge to the expected value that's indicated by log 2 over here. Although that we have some large error bars, but at least you can see that there is a signal that RNN is kind of learning these topological features in our system. And to conclude, there's also other ways we can use RNNs, for instance, in real-world applications, for instance, for solving combinatorial optimization problems. So this is, for instance, work that I did with Estelle Inak, who is doing research, who started her startup out of this research project on using RNNs for solving combinatorial optimization problems using another concept called annealing. So this is an interesting approach. If you're interested, you can check it out. And there's also another follow-up to work to this research over here. And if you are interested to learn more broadly about this area of research, you can check out these two nice reviews. So this is the first one by my supervisor, Juan Kurskia, about machine learning for quantum matter. And there's also this other review if you're interested to learn more about the different applications, not only for RNNs, but different machine learning architectures for quantum systems. And something interesting I wanted to something that could be a good question that for a question that will be interesting to think about in the future will be, for instance, recently we have seen that there's an interesting revolution with the ChatGPT, which is also a language model. The question would be, like, if we use maybe a very large language model, much bigger than an RNN, for instance, if we use a large language model with billions or trillions of parameters, instead of only RNNs, which only has thousands of parameters, what would be the results? Can we study even more phases of matter? Can we maybe discover some other unsolved mysteries in a strongly correlated system? So that would be an interesting question to explore in the near future. And to conclude, so I hope I convinced you that there's some connection between natural language processing and quantum physics. And I've also shown you through these lectures that we can use RNNs to study quantum systems, and we can go to very large system sizes, and we can also compete with the state-of-the-art methods, and we can also handle physical symmetries. And at the end, the question I want to leave this lecture with is the fact that there's a lot of promise, and we can still explore more on the intersection of language models and quantum physics. So I hope these set of lectures were helpful, and I look forward to your questions. And thanks very much, everyone, for your attention.